Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. Good to be back after a week off out in the wilds of Wales. Tonight, I want to have a look at the work of a man called Daniel Stone, or that's what we're going to be basing our discussion around. And I'm hoping to be talking about meditation and conscious dreaming and some of the techniques that are involved in achieving that, why it's important that we might consider it, and how, as it turns out, many of us are already engaged, as it happens, in some of the realizations we need to make to do this kind of work. In a world where we've become pretty convinced that we're dealing with something that's mostly material and a little bit energetic, the shamans of old and of the present day have all concentrated, as have many, many ancient wisdoms, on the energetic nature of the world we live in fundamentally, and the fact that as energetic parts of it, we have a part in the creation of what we see and what we do. And as it happens, developing the kind of focus that enables us to dream consciously, to take some sort of creative part in what's going on, and remembering it rather than just simply forgetting, is related pretty closely to the way we need to start focusing in our everyday lives. And as I say, many of us have, as it happens, started doing that anyway. So we're going to be looking at how it is we might participate in this energetic world more actively, some of the ways in which we're actually, perhaps without even noticing it, already participating in it, and some of the reasons why we should be doing that and the kind of history behind it. Daniel Stone's book is called The Dreamer Who Dreams You, The Shaman, The Buddha and The Conscious Dream. I'm particularly interested in it because I have become aware many times over the last two or three years that several challenges that I'm facing in everyday life are being answered in my dreams, and I'm just kind of waking up with a sort of solution, as it were. I also realise that when things are going really difficultly with a given project and something isn't happening quite as I'd like it to happen, then just putting it away and ignoring it and having a night's kip, quite often by the next morning I'm able to engage with it and all of the problems have evaporated. And I'm pretty sure that this is because my subconscious mind is dealing with things when I'm fast asleep better than it sometimes deals with them when I'm awake. Now, it is my hope at some point to have Daniel onto the show to have a talk about what he's doing. He runs a place called the Center for Conscious Dreaming out in the Sonora Desert in Mexico. Some of you will remember that my friend and helpmeet, who's going to help me on the show tonight, Synchro Sister. Hi, Synchro.
Hi there.
She went on a four-week course in Mexico a while back and did basically 4 weeks of learning how to focus and many other things. And she was working with Daniel out there. So she's going to help as we work our way through some of the ideas that become apparent in his book. Perhaps it'd be a good idea, Synchro, if you could, to tell us the kind of work you were doing out there. What was your aim when you went there, and how did it kind of work out for you?
Well, as you know, I was strongly attracted to go to Mexico to work with Daniel. It was almost an intuitive decision, really, that I had to go. And it was funny how it happened, but we won't go into that here. And after I decided I was going to go on Daniel's course, which is called the 12 Conscious Dreamers Journey to Mexico, then I realised I'd have to fly over the Atlantic to get there. And that was a bit disconcerting and quite a feat for me to undertake. But we went more or less straight to the desert. We did some exercises for the first few days around in Mexico City and around the area surrounding Mexico City. We spent a couple of days camping very near to, I can't say it properly, but I'll give it a go, Teotihuacan, the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon. We were camping close enough to see the pyramids and walked there from the camp. It was fantastic. But then we were off to the desert, which is where I'll go now, because it's where we had most of our, well, extraordinary experiences. although many of them were very ordinary as well, because a lot of what we were doing was learning how to focus our intention so that we would be able to, I suppose, see more clearly, but also to perceive the world in a different way. And we'll go into that a bit more later, I think.
Yeah.
But we did, I was there for about 3 weeks, and every single day that we were there, we had some kind of task exercise on. And it wasn't about running about the desert, although there was some of that as well. But it was things like the first day, I think, we went out into the desert in a direction of our choice, because you can walk from the Centre for Conscious Dreaming in any direction for at least an hour and you won't come across any civilization, so to speak, at all. It's just scrub.
Is it just desert?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just desert.
So not a lot to concentrate on out there then.
Well, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised, because that's what we spent most of our time doing.
So although it was a kind of conscious dreaming course, you're actually being taught how to concentrate on the physical, the material world.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what did you do in the first days in the desert?
Well, one of the first things we did was walk out into the desert in the direction of our choice. We hadn't really explored the desert much. We were new to it. So we set out into the scrub, and dotted around everywhere with really amazing acacia trees. In fact, they were the only kind of tree in the desert. The rest of it was scrub and bushes. The creosote bush, I remember, smelt very strongly of creosote, funnily enough. And so we went out, and we had been given the task of making our own medicine wheel in the desert, basically to the four directions and the centre, of course, because when you make a medicine wheel, the centre is there. And we spent all day out in the desert making our own personal medicine wheel.
Yeah.
And this involved walking to look for rocks. Yeah. We set off in the direction of north to find the rock that was going to mark north.
Yeah.
And there weren't many rocks in the desert. Yeah. So you had to walk some way to find the rock.
That, if nothing else, that was centering you in the actual world with the directions in a place that you'd only just arrived at.
That's right. And we needed to do that, because going into the desert there, after all the craziness of Mexico, the lovely craziness of Mexico, going to a place where there was a relatively small group of people living in this circular camp made out of adobe houses. I was in a tent because I hadn't booked an adobe house, which was interesting. And then there was a massive train. There was a railway line that ran not that far away, a few miles away from the centre of conscious dreaming. So every day you'd get this massive, great big train with sometimes up to 137 coaches on it, rumbling through the desert.
I suppose if you're going to move a few, you might as well move many.
It was one of the main Mexico-America trade routes, so to speak. Yeah.
So once you'd oriented yourself and done your medicine wheel, what else occurred out there? Because presumably you were kind of increasing your sense of focus as time went by, were you?
Well, that was definitely the idea. Mm. And some, obviously everybody dealt with that differently. Some people were more perhaps experienced in focusing, that they could dive straight into it. And I think some people had less experience in that way and found it more difficult, especially in the first few days, because you're also dealing with quite a close-knit group, community of people.
You've always got to deal with the emotional stuff, haven't you? How people respond to each other.
And of course, everybody's coming from different places, you know.
It's quite funny, that, isn't it, really? Because the desert, one of the things about it, as Daniel says in the book, is that it gets rid of a lot of distractions, because there isn't a lot of stuff out there. And yet, by arriving on a course, you've actually imported a fair few distractions as you sort yourselves out with each other.
Of course.
Yeah. And so basically, the idea is to remove the distraction and to give yourself some chance to focus on the real world, something that we don't get a lot of chance to do in the West because we tend to have the television on and the radio on. And actually, especially in cities, there is just so much stimulation from billboards and all the rest of the stuff. There's all the things you want to do tomorrow, all the things that you didn't do yesterday, kind of whatever. Everybody's got a myriad of pressures around them. But by moving yourself out to the desert, you're actually successfully getting rid of loads of that stuff, stuff that we'd have to work to sideline, as we're talking a bit about later.
One of the interesting things we were asked to do, and there was varying amounts of resistance to this, was when we arrived at the nearest village where Daniel has a base, one of the things we were asked to do was to give up all our possessions, other than what we'd need in the desert to survive, like clothes and things like that. So everybody put in their mobile phones, whatever, passports, money, flight tickets, all their admin, if you like, for their journey, and their ability to contact the outside world, because there's no internet access, no mobile phones out there at the Centre for Conscious Dreaming, for very good reasons, because they are nothing but, as you say, distractions.
Yeah. And they take you away from the place that you're in.
Yeah.
And it also means to people giving up things that they're really, really not used to giving up.
Mm.
And in fact, I heard that some people have kind of the chemicals that are stimulated in the brain by contact with high technology, with mobile phones and stuff, is similar to love that they might feel for individuals. So it must have been a real wrench for some.
Yeah, some people were very resistant, credit cards, all that stuff left behind. I didn't have too much of a problem, to be honest.
You haven't got any.
We were allowed to bring cameras in, but we were asked to use them sensitively in the desert, which was fine by me.
Yeah, you got some nice shots out there.
Yeah, cameras were fine,
but
not to be clicking away all the time, because that's just a distraction. Yeah.
So fundamentally what we're talking about, because we'll hear more about your experience in the desert as we work our way through, but fundamentally what we're talking about is shaving away as many distractions as possible and getting to grips with the people that are around you. How long were you actually in the desert for?
About 3 weeks in all, I think.
Mm.
Because we spent about a week, the whole course was a month, and we spent about a week arriving in Mexico City and visiting sacred sites in and around Mexico City. So within the environs of Mexico City for about a week, I think.
So you were presumably actually going through this with this withdrawal of facilities slowly, really, because it would have happened when you landed, really.
Well, we had a more social time, I think, in the first week. There was a lot of getting to know each other. And
you might remind me about that walk you were asked to do, because that seemed to me to be a tremendous...
It was a wonderful introduction to the work in the desert, and the more I look at the course from this time, because it was a couple of years ago now, the more I look at it now, the more I can see how, Daniel might say, these things aren't just thrown together, you know. The whole thing is just like perfectly designed to bring you into a state ready to go to the desert.
Yeah.
So one of the days we were camping in this lovely gorge outside Mexico City, and we were staying in teepees, wonderful place, lovely food, really amazing. Mm. And there was a temple in the rock there. You actually went into this big cleft in the rock, and it was a place to sit and meditate, which was amazing because you were actually enclosed by this ancient cliff.
Mm.
But one day we had a special treat. There was this old man, I think his name was Don Julio, and he was well into his 80s, a small, wizened Mexican man. And he spoke the old language, and I think it said something like Nahuatl.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke that, and it's one of the old sacred languages. Well, languages, anyway. And he took us, and he didn't say much. We found some ruined temples that the local people had decided not to have excavated, which I thought was great. And there were many portals during the day that he took us through. And sometimes it was a pair of old trees Sometimes it was a door in an old temple. But we did this whole perambulation around this wonderful countryside, really amazingly beautiful countryside, until we arrived at a very special place, which was it translated meant the wall of memory. And he just pointed at this wall and directed us to listen to the wall, basically, to be with the wall and to tune into its memory. And we spent a good half hour there, I think, just being with this wall. I remember I put my forehead, well, in fact, my whole self against the wall. And there really was a sense of communication that this wasn't just me experiencing a wall.
Yeah.
The wall was experiencing me as well.
Which is fundamentally what this evening's show is about.
Yeah.
It's about the fact that we are energetically interrelating with things, and that everything we come across, everything around us, has got memory and energy stored in it, which we in the Western world are more or less completely ignorant of. And even if we knew about it, we wouldn't have the time to give it.
Well, I think we've been positively disencouraged, to be honest, from accessing the fact that we have the ability to tune into a wall, a wall of solid rock, and share its memory.
Yeah.
We've been positively discouraged from that kind of stuff. That's called crazy stuff, isn't it?
It is. It is. But really what you're doing there is you're starting to tune into the kind of world that shamans occupy. They occupy an energetic world, don't they? They talk about bringing bits of people's spirit back. They somehow manage to get the recipe for ayahuasca, which is quite complicated and scientifically advanced, by talking to plants. All of this stuff is things that comes completely naturally to many of the people in Mexico, as far as I can gather. I know that Daniel seems to have been an inveterate shaman hunter. I've met an inveterate guru hunter, but it sounds like he went all over the world. He went to talk to Tibetan Buddhists. He went to Mexico. Mexico seems to be the place that he liked particularly. But he realised that kind of all the shamans, that one of the things that seems persistently to have disappointed him is that every shaman you find who's got something decent to teach you is busy slagging off another shaman for using the wrong shaped stick, or singing the wrong song, or not using this, or using the wrong sort of medicine wheel, because there's several different sorts, aren't there? And he says that if shamans taught me anything, it is how to listen to the earth, to the stars and planets. The most important lesson I have learned from them is that everything speaks, everything has a language. The trees, the plants, the rocks, the rivers, the mountains and the sea. He writes really beautifully, I think.
He does.
Yeah. And really, I guess we have to recognise that this all this sort of complexity and beauty, the voices, the trees, the rocks, the rivers, the elements of which they are made, and the dreamers who dream them, all sprang from a single primal moment, from the very first breath. And this is the kind of history of shamanism. It works on breath, doesn't it? On this cosmic breath, which is why the breath meditation is more than just the means of stilling our mind and stilling the body. It's because we are entering into this process of breathing, which is shared by everything. Daniel says that the experiences in the desert taught me that the greatest teachers are all around us and inside us. They are waiting for the opportunity to be heard. When the space is made, there is a chance to listen. And that was the aim of going to the desert.
Exactly.
And it's also really the aim of general breath meditation and the single point meditation that we're probably going to be talking about later in the show. And these things, by tuning yourself into these things in what we might call the everyday world, the waking dream, shall we say, you are training your mind to understand how consciously to dream. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say so. Well, I believe so now. I've been interested in dreaming for many years, as you know, and I've been following my dreams and listening to my dreams for a long time. But the experience in the desert helped me to realize that the awake dream, as we call it, is connected very, very closely with the asleep dream. In fact, they're interdependent. They are so closely connected that we really don't want to be separating them.
No.
So that the more conscious we become in our awake world, the more conscious we become in the dream world, and vice versa.
So do you think that implies that, I mean, we know that that once you become consciously involved in your dreams, you become the kind of creator, the orchestrator of the dream. Do you think that by coming more conscious in the everyday world, that we're becoming more of a creator of that as well? Or are we simply acknowledging the creators that we already are?
Well, no, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say, is that they are inseparable, because they are both... If you can fly in a dream, you obviously believe that you can fly because you're flying.
Yeah.
If you believe you can do something in your awake world, you're going to be able to do it because you believe you can.
Yeah.
Now, the flying might help you to manifest and empower you in your everyday world, but also the manifestation in your everyday world will enable you to become more of a participant in the creation of your dream, because it's like a film you're making.
Yeah. And basically, the idea is, isn't it, that we're echoing that kind of original primal breath of the kind of one mind, that at some point things changed, and that there was an exhalation, is the way Daniel puts it, but sometime a long, long time ago, before everything became complicated, there was this one simple thing, the monad, we might call it, or the one mind, and it breathed. And I think that Daniel's little bit at the very, more or less at the beginning of his first chapter, is really great, because he says, we start at the beginning, first breath, without intention, an exhalation, no thought, by itself, it began. Breath of no thing, natural, nothing. There is no difference. And then an inhalation, appearing different, from no breath to breath, but there was no intention. It was nothing. It still is nothing. And then the catch. That's the point. After that inhalation, there's the realization that something's changed. And what he's basically saying there is that everything comes from nothing. Everything comes from no thing. Mm. And this was one of the first places that I realized that we were actually looking at something that we're facing every day. I know the people that are listening will recognize this experience. We know that the policeman is only a policeman if you put the uniform on. We know that the warrant is only a warrant if you believe it's anything other than a piece of paper. It's possibly not even that. It's just a thing out there. So those things spring from no thing as a result of the interaction of our consciousness. So in a sense, we're really making them.
Yep.
So this kind of... there was a sort of realization for Daniel, wasn't there, that in some sense all the stuff that he'd felt to be really real and tangible was actually in some sense kind of being created by him, and everything kind of fell away from him. He said that I was staring one enormous question in the face: what is real? And the only answer I could feel was nothing. In my breath there was something that wasn't breathing. My breath was something and nothing at the same time. And he said that he experienced in that moment, that's a kind of shamanic falling away of everything. It's kind of shamanic death, isn't it? Where all the stuff that you held to be true isn't. That the actual basis of everything is not as you understood it. And he said that his preliminary experience to that was one of anxiety and dread. And that out of that basically grew a feeling of love. Now, I was particularly struck in that little passage there, that he said, in my breath there was something that wasn't breathing. My breath was something and nothing at the same time. There's something that was breathing. My breath was something and nothing at the same time. Mm. Because it reminds me of the kinesiology experience when you have a muscle test and your muscles kind of go slack when your body wants to say no to a question, and it stays firm when you want to say yes. And I've seen people being asked questions that they don't know the answers to, but their inner them seems to, their muscular system responds. Is that related, do you think?
I'm not sure, actually. How would that be related?
To the thing that's breathing within.
Well, yes, because, doesn't he say somewhere that the breath becomes the body,
yeah,
and the body becomes the breath? Again, they can't be separated.
No.
To be one thing and another.
Yeah.
Because they are, again, so totally interconnected, like the dream world and our awake world. We've learnt to separate them and to consider the dream world to be something irrelevant.
Yeah.
You know, not many people, I don't know, some people do, I do, talk about their dreams or even remember them.
Mm.
So we negate the significance of the dream world in our modern day busyness,
yeah,
full of distraction.
And we also call things like telepathy and telekinesis and poltergeists and stuff, we call all of that parapsychology.
Yeah.
We're actually kind of cutting it away from reality, mm, and suggesting that it's something else, that it's like this, but it's, yeah, not quite the same.
People say you're away with the fairies. And I know where, you know, I certainly don't mind being called away with the fairies, because that's a compliment as far as I'm, yeah, concerned.
Yes, indeed.
I know where I'd like to be.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this show was as a kind of introduction to some of the guests we've got coming up. And we've got Serena Roney Douglas at Dougal on next week, who wrote a book called Where Science and Magic Meet. And she does a lot of psychic research. In fact, that's what she's been doing. By really synchronistic miracle, she ended up doing her master's and a PhD in psychic research, and then has managed to carry on doing it. And so she's actually using scientific techniques to try and bring this alternative world that we're encouraged to completely ignore back into everyday language, as it were. I'm really looking forward to having her on. But so there's a kind of paradox, isn't there, here? Because we know that in this shamanic world, all of the work that's being done is with the energy world. It's energetic. We know they get results. We also know about all manner of things. We know about telepathy, spontaneous remission, dowsing. There's a whole load of things that actually tell us that it's an energetic world that we're responding to. We're trying to somehow, as you say, we're being convinced to kind of sideline it. It seems that one of the reasons why we need to start concentrating on something like meditation is because that'll make this paradox disappear. You had the opportunity of going all the way out to the desert and things to get rid of all of the distractions around you. It seems to me that a kind of workaday solution to that in the Western world is to at least start considering the idea of meditating on a regular basis,
mm,
because then these, basically, the profound, these, the depths of the breath, which are connected to that one cosmic breath at the beginning, all of the paradoxes cease to create tension. That there's places in the breath where there's nothing to be explained.
Yeah, I like that description very, yeah, much.
So one of the problems we have with that is one of the problems that you've already alluded to. We've got really busy minds, and whenever it is that we try to stop them, we get caught up basically with trains of thought. So I know that when I first started meditating, I had a feeling basically of frustration, and it was for exactly the reasons that that Daniel suggests in his book, because he suggests fundamentally what we get is a feeling of frustration. Because I think somehow we're kind of edged towards believing that what we're going to get when we start doing meditation is calm or pleasure or fluffiness. And Daniel describes this as a kind of war state in our mind, because we're sitting there and we're trying to calm a thing that really can't be calmed because it's there to think. So that's what it wants to do, and that's what it does. And people quite often get stuck there. And I think his description of what meditation is actually for is really brilliant, really sensitive, because he says the point of breath awareness meditation is not to have a particular thought or feeling or sensation, but to become aware of what the thoughts and feelings and sensations are. Our busy minds cloud our deeper sensations, feelings and thoughts, both pleasurable and painful. Breath meditation deepens our level of experience. So we're talking about focus there, aren't we?
Indeed. And we are going to go into the one-point meditation, yeah, aren't we, in a bit. So that's a really good time to go into that in a bit, yeah, more depth, I think.
Yeah, although I guess by concentrating, I mean, I know that when I wake up in the dead of night having had a difficult dream and my pulse is racing and my heart's beating really loud and all that kind of stuff, I've in the past found it quite difficult to recover from that, and it's sometimes taken me 2 or 3 hours to go back to sleep again. But now I find that if I concentrate on my breath, it gets rid of whatever it is that's invaded my head to make me feel like that, and it does have a physical effect on the body. It does calm it.
Yeah.
And really, the breath meditation, being able to concentrate on your breath for 15 minutes or so, just the practice of that is at the very root of the...
Oh, it is.
Yeah, I mean, the one-point meditation is kind of really fundamental, but...
Yeah, I mean, focusing on the breath is a good place to start.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a really good place to start before you start the one-point meditation. I agree, because that's the beginning.
And it's the start of stripping away the illusion.
It is, because if your breath becomes your whole focus, then there's no room for anything else. It actually, everything else recedes from you as you do that. And then there is no thought.
Yeah.
That's what happens.
And I think the fact that it can calm a body for it, it can be used just that. I find a single deep breath, in fact, can really start calming down a body that's become overexcited.
Yeah. Well, we forget to breathe. A lot of people breathe very, very shallowly in their everyday lives. And it is really good advice to take a few deep breaths if you're facing a stressful situation, or if you're about to perform or sing or talk to somebody or whatever. A few deep breaths before you do anything can really help to still you.
Yeah.
And focus you.
Yes.
Because you're taking your attention to the breath.
Yeah.
Even if it's just for 3 breaths, it's worth doing.
And it does have to be said that by doing this and by stripping away the surrounding stuff and the distraction, you may well be bringing yourself to some points that you haven't looked at before that might not be entirely...
Well, exactly, because there is inspiration in the stillness and silence. Inspiration.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we are inspiring and exhaling, aren't we?
Yeah.
That's exactly what we're doing. And you by stilling the mind, for want of better words to describe it, because that sounds a bit combative and I don't mean to be combative, but by focusing on the breath, to put it another way, there is no room for thought. So there is room for inspiration.
And intuition and hunches. So
the space is made to let inspiration in.
That's it.
And then you exhale. And that's all the breathing is about, basically. Yeah.
And this experience needn't necessarily to start with be calm entirely, because some of the things that arise when you get rid of all of the barriers and all of the distractions are going to be the first things that you need to address. Yeah. But they are simply thoughts, and it is advised, isn't it, that they're not kind of addressed at that point, that you just let it fall.
Yeah. And I don't mean that people should go into a breath meditation seeking inspiration, because that is not the idea.
No.
But that you might well find, as you develop your 15 minutes of focusing on the breath, that you will come round or come out of that meditation feeling inspired.
Yeah. Yes. So Daniel says it may be hell.
It may be hell.
But he does say it may be heaven, and it may be undramatic,
mm-hmm.
Even boring. But it depends on your truth in the moment of the breath.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that's arising is as a result of our own internal truth. And
you will experience, as he calls it, the war state. You probably will experience a turmoil when you first try to do that.
Yeah.
And it's not about conquering that turmoil or combating it or fighting with it. It's about letting it go.
Yeah.
It's about letting it go.
Yeah. And I think that must be true of the waking dream as well, because in the waking moment, it's our truth and its consequences that form our experience and the reaction of the world to our truth. You know, it's the way we see the world that's forming it in front of us.
Well, that's right. And then, like the dream, when you become more able to participate in the creation of your own dream, when you're asleep, it can reflect and will reflect in your everyday life.
Yeah. And Daniel says that the war stage might last for 5 minutes or for 50, but usually for most people it calms down with the natural flow of breath. As he says, nothing stays the same forever. The natural breath is the tool to quieten the mind. When the mind is quiet, there is insight. Sand in the desert is picked up by the wind, and when the wind passes, the sand gradually settles back into the earth. Excuse me. The vision opens by degrees through war and peace, and the mysteries in the breath of the universe are revealed. I actually really like that image of the sand getting lifted by the wind, and when the wind's passed, the sand just drops back into the vast sand that is the desert.
Yeah, it's a good description, because I don't think I'd seen sand devils before. Maybe little tiny ones by the side of the road in the dust, in the leaves, by the pavement and in the leaves and stuff. But in the desert, they are quite spectacular. Some of them are quite small, only about 6 foot tall or 7 foot tall or something like that. And some of them are quite big, like reaching up into the sky. But it's always the wind that's flowing through the desert that lifts the sand up. But instead of just it being a cloud of sand, it takes on the form of a vortex, like water going down a plug hole.
Yeah.
It takes on the shape of a vortex, tiny at the bottom, really big at the top, and it's spinning really quite fast, depending on the speed of the wind, I suppose. Must be a certain speed of wind to make it lift.
And they're quite common in the desert.
They're all the time, because it is actually a very windy place, probably because there's mountains nearby. We could see the mountains from the desert, and really beautiful they are too.
Did they always run away, or did you sometimes see the sand just...
No, you see it just falling down again.
So, oh,
really? It just disappear. Yeah, because I remember thinking, oh, there's a big one of those, you know, what's that sort of thing? And it was coming towards me, and I was thinking I was going to be caught in this mini sandstorm. But no, it fell away before my eyes and ceased to exist. And sometimes you'd see them spinning off into the desert. Mm. But they never actually, I never experienced one. It fell
never
away.
Never came near you.
No, no.
I think it's just a brilliant metaphor for thoughts in meditation.
Mm.
This idea that all the sand gets lifted up, it spins around for a while, and then it just falls back into the desert again.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, how we need to approach the thoughts.
Yes, quite a useful little meditation, really, to, if you're having problems, letting go of your thought and focusing on the breath. Just to imagine a few sand devils releasing their sand back to the desert.
Yeah.
Eventually you let go of all those thoughts and just focus on the breath.
Yeah. Well, I don't need to actually go too much into how to settle into meditation, because Freeman Jack did a really great job on it. I'm sure his podcast's up there. I didn't mean to get hold of the link to that and post it in now, but I didn't. So anybody who wants to, it's actually, he did a really great description of how to approach. He was doing transcendental meditation, but the same thing really applies here. In fact, it was so good that I got myself sitting cross-legged on the floor, and because Jack's on late at night, I probably fell asleep, woke up with a pair of dead legs and a nodding head. But I think one of the points he made, which I think is really important, is that there are no rules that you've got to apply to, because everybody's different. Everybody's got different abilities to sit for a given length of time and different shaped spines and all manner of things. So people's requirements are fundamentally going to be different. But Daniel, I think this again is really useful, because he makes it really simple. Otherwise, it's easy to distract yourself from the meditation by trying to get into the full lotus position or trying to actually sit freestyle upright instead of with your back against the wall, or maybe sit in a chair or near, whatever it is you want to do. And Daniel says that basically the main things, the first thing is that we need to be comfortable, because pain and discomfort will certainly distract us from what it is we're trying to do. We need to be undisturbed, which is one of the whole points, isn't it, of the desert experience, and the whole thing is to try and get rid of all disturbance and distraction so that you can for a while concentrate on your breathing. And he says that it's important that you have the spine as erect as possible, which is obviously going to differ from people to people. So comfort, not being disturbed, and sitting as upright as you can manage. One of the reasons for that is because all of the messages that your mind gets and your intuition and everything seem to come basically through that sort of central core. One of the things he suggested, which I think is really good, is he basically suggests that just once a day, only for 15 minutes, if you can sit there and start trying to do this, then actual perseverance will help, and a degree of regularity as well, because your mind and your body get used to it. That way, one of the things that he suggested, which I really liked and which I actually find quite helpful, I tried it kind of a couple of days ago, is he suggests we start experimenting with breathing and movement, regular movement. Mm. He suggests that you try kind of moving to the left and inhaling and then moving to the right and exhaling, and give that a go for a while, and then try it the other way around. Move to the right and inhale, move to the left and exhale. And he suggests trying it inhaling and exhaling in each of those positions.
Well, what he's doing there, I think, is he's involving the body in the focus on the breath. So it's a physical movement to accompany the breath, and that will help you to focus and to let go of your thoughts.
Yeah. And we do, of course, when people are trying to relax themselves after a bit of trauma, they do rock backwards and forwards.
They
so
do.
I guess rocking side to side.
And you rock a baby to sleep.
You do rock a baby to sleep, either in its pram or in your arms. Mm. That's true. Mm. So again, it's relaxing, isn't it?
The other thing you can do, of course, is any job or any task or any activity that you can do which enables you to go into a reverie, almost like a dreamlike reverie, is a wonderful thing to do. I mean, people find that in all sorts of different places, and you'll probably know what yours is. Quite often for me, it's gardening. I find that I can garden, and whilst I'm gardening, I'm focusing on the task in hand, but I don't need to think about it too much. So I go off into a wonderful reverie, and it's like what people probably say, that I'm away with the fairies.
Yeah.
And it's where I want to be.
Yeah. Or a dreamer.
Or you're a dreamer.
You're a dreamer, you know. Yeah. Daydreaming again.
That's it. And I know that Serena recommends daydreaming as being a really valuable activity. Whether you're doing something or not, if you're just sitting in a chair, daydreaming is a really valuable activity.
Yes, Serena says that daydreaming is one of the best exercises for the subliminal mind.
But I find that walking or painting or gardening or whatever it is you do, some people get it through jogging, running, but, you know, they're more active activities. But I think anything you can do that takes your mind off things, as people say, is really, really excellent.
And it is true to say that if you're doing something really mundane, like washing up or housework, something that you can do without too much concentration and you know how to do, but you need to do it well, it's quite easy to concentrate, to take the opportunity then to concentrate on your breath, isn't it? You don't actually, if you find you can't sit still, then trying to bring a bit of this stuff into everyday work is a good, or everyday activity is a good idea.
Well, you know, I'm a great believer in small achievable tasks, as I call them. And anything that you can do that focuses you and gives you a sense of accomplishment as well. I think that's quite important for me anyway. Walking over mountains, for example, you know, you see the mountain, you intend to walk up it, you do it, you get to the top and you get the great view, and then you return or walk down the other side. And in that time, you've got loads and loads of time for what some people might call spacing out or daydreaming or sitting with rocks or trees or whatever it is you choose to do along the way. And you're in another world, in a sense. If you're not constantly looking at your mobile phone or whatever, I tend not to not to even take them on those trips, you know. So there's no distraction or very little. And then you'll notice, as we've talked about before with Fred Gillam, you'll notice signs from nature, the bird crossing your path or
a rune in sticks on the ground or a creature that's crossing your path that you can,
because you've let go of your distractions. And that's what I find really helpful, like say about gardening or anything that you do.
So basically, daydreaming can join meditation and a trip to the desert as a means of stripping yourself outpacing your distractions. I like distraction, by the way, because it suggests that it's taking you away from getting traction on the energetic world that we're dealing with.
Which is like when people say, "Oh, get a grip," isn't it?
Yeah.
You get a grip on the world.
Yeah.
Through getting rid of your distractions. I like that too.
And Daniel says that as the meditation deepens, the body becomes the breath and the breath becomes the body.
Exactly.
And the same is true of the daydreaming, really, in its way. But
You don't have to direct. Well, you do, actually. Yeah, you do direct your daydreamings. But I often don't know where I'm going with it or even remember it when I get back. I just know I've been away.
Yeah.
And that's I find that really helpful.
Yeah. Daniel also says that patience in these meditations is the virtue. Consistency and perseverance will give the breath a chance to teach you what you already know. Because this is the thing, is that somehow all of the distractions of the modern world, the mobile phones, and I find the internet communication, it takes up so much time. And it's all somewhere else. And it's generally dealing with something that has just been done or something that needs to be done. And it's moving us out of the present.
Yeah, away from the moment.
Yeah. So being in the moment, and I really would say that the perseverance is that's a regular lesson on the meditation, to stick with it, because it's if nothing else, if you're going to have easy times and difficult times, if you don't persevere with it, you're going to miss the easy and rewarding ones. But also, I think consistency is another thing that is being kind of bred out of us. So it's because if it's true of meditation, it's true of eating as well. You know, people tend to eat on the hoof. They eat irregularly. Sometimes they have a big breakfast and sometimes they have a big supper. And I know that we're finding out, aren't we, that it's actually really quite advantageous to be consistent in that as well. So I think it's a general message that our energetic systems really appreciate a degree of order.
Yeah, it reminds me of that little phrase, before enlightenment, fetch wood, carry water.
After enlightenment,
fetch wood, carry water.
Yeah.
I've always loved that, because basically we always need to do those things, and those things are a part of our experience. And indeed, enlightenment, when you think of the word enlightenment, it means that you become lighter, and that involves letting go of things that will inhibit you.
Yeah.
And maybe hold you back from that lightening that comes about.
Yeah.
Everybody can do with some enlightenment.
Yeah, definitely.
In that sense, you know.
Yes, what we need is more levity.
That's it.
Yeah, more levity, less gravity. Yeah. In the breath is the memory of all the knowledge you hold in yourself, he says, which I think is really good. And that actually gives a chance to, I'll see if I can find that, hang on a moment, because Serena says something similar. She says there's evidence that the subliminal mind retains every experience in its entirety. And when I was thinking that Daniel suggested that meditation gives you a chance, gives your inner self basically a chance to teach you what you already know, it brought this...
Or to remember.
To remember, yeah. Because to a certain extent we get the... Well, I certainly get the impression that there's sort of other parts of us that know what's going on. And before we came here, we did have a pretty good grip of it. But there's something with coming here that is to do with forgetting. Well, these are the words Serena uses. She's talking about the subliminal mind in her book Where Science and Magic Meet, which rather cryptically on the back says science stroke new science as classifications, which I think is quite funny because it gives you some implication as to what the old science is. But see, this is what she says. She says, I think it is important to stress that there is evidence that the subliminal mind retains every experience in its entirety. There are billions of nerve connections in the brain, and so physically we can process billions of items of information at any one time. Digestion, blood flow, body temperature, all sounds physically present in the environment, all sights, all taste, all touch, everything that is physically present is registered at a subliminal level. And all of this is retained. At a subliminal level, we see, hear, feel, and remember everything, every little detail. Then we have to add to this all of the psychic awareness which we're potentially capable of possessing. If you accept such abilities as telepathy, clairvoyance and precognition, then you must realise that we are literally, potentially omniscient. This is an attribute normally given to divinity, and it is true for our subliminal mind. Thus, at a subliminal level, we are potentially divine, potentially omniscient, potentially able to know everything that ever has been, is and will be in the whole universe. There are, at present, no known limits to psychic awareness. Let me repeat, she says, everything, all subliminal stimuli, all psi stimuli, all body processes, everything is incorporated into this mind. Potentially, at the subconscious level, we are aware of everything that ever was, is, or will be. We are omniscient. We are divine.
Mm. Beautifully put, Serena.
Yeah. And like I say, she says that the best training, the best exercise for the subliminal mind is daydreaming.
Mm, mm.
And what we're talking about here is in our terms through breath meditation, but in shamanic terms through a much deeper study and a deeper knowledge of it, we're talking about accessing that omniscience.
Mm.
When they say they're getting recipes for complex things like ayahuasca by talking to the plants, it's because it's actually within them, and if it's within them, it's within us. So one of the aims of talking about conscious dreaming and about meditation is to try and open up the possibility that we can explore these subjects a little bit deeper within ourselves. I'm going to play a couple of tunes whilst we sort out the next bit, and have a quick look in the chat box, which is actually looking pretty quiet this evening. Is everybody all right out there? Hey, oh, there was a little bit going on. So here we go. A couple of tunes kicking off with, after our little MSI intro, Eye Monster and Daydream in Blue.
This is Media Streaming International Radio.
Vibe asked how we get, I think it was Vibe, asked how we get into the vortex, which is a good question. Do you want to kick off with the trout then, Synchro? I know you'll have heard a little bit of this whilst we were talking over the music.
Yeah, but. Well, I was inspired to read one of Victor Schaumburger's books where he describes when he spent a lot of time on his own in a wooden hut in the Austrian forests because he was a forester. And he also worked with water because they used to, their logs used to travel down in these runways down to where they were needed. So he was very interested in water and how it flowed. And he and I had been puzzled for years about how salmon and trout and fish jump up incredibly high waterfalls, because they can do it. I've seen them do it. And what they do, and you'll have to check out the technicalities of this by following up some of Victor Schaumburger's work, which is brilliant, all of it. And what he was watching, a trout jumping up in a waterfall one day, he realized that what it was doing was it swimming up to the waterfall, finding a water vortex in the waterfall, and then the trout uses its energy to spin with the vortex and actually uses the energy of the vortex to jump up to the top of the waterfall. Because it's an amazing thing. I don't know if any of you have ever seen a fish leaping up a high waterfall. It's an incredible thing
to
see.
They can be really big fish, can't they? They've got
big
a lot
fish,
of mass.
Big waterfalls. I've seen salmon leaping up, I don't know, 10, 15 feet of wall of water. And they use this vortex.
They're actually generating levity, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah.
They are.
In fact, if you want to find out a bit more about Schaumburger and the vortices in water, then you could do a lot worse than go onto YouTube, look up the Truth Juice Gathering 2013, and click on the talk that John Bide gives, because he talks a lot about vortexes. He's even got one modelled that he can watch in his own kitchen.
Yeah.
My thought, one of the biggest realisations I had to do with the vortex was when I realised that when you see a whirlpool in water, it's an energy pattern in a river and the water's flowing through it. So that the water, it's not that the water in is going round and round. The water's running through the vortex. There's an energy pattern there. But it can drown you.
Yep, yeah. We were always told to keep away from water whirlpools in the river when we were kids, because the whirlpool is formed by the water coming into a particular land formation, which causes it to make a big spin, usually clockwise, I think.
It'll depend on the shape of the land.
It'll depend on the shape of the land, won't it? Of course it will. Of course they'll go both ways, won't they? But the land creates the spin in the water, which leads to a vortex, which is right in the centre of the big spinning water.
Yeah.
Right in the centre. Mm. Very powerful things they can be. Yeah. Like water going down a plug hole.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah. So many things are like that. And another of my recent discoveries was the a thing that John Bide again told me, that it's called the long body of the sun. I saw a picture of it on the front of the Little Book of Coincidence published by Wooden Books, but it didn't. I saw that years ago and didn't really think about it. But there's now an amazing video on YouTube called The Earth Does Not Revolve Around the Sun, Part 2, is what its full title is. And it shows you that the planets don't kind of revolve around the sun in the same way as you might find kind of lines on an intricate saucer. That what's actually happening is the sun is barreling through space ahead of the solar system. It doesn't itself barrel on a straight line either. It makes a kind of big loop and then a smaller loop every 50 years. And the line around which it is doing this is determined by the mass of the solar system and its movement. And what the Earth Does Not Revolve Around the Sun does is it presents an animation of the planets spinning in their various, their own energetic patterns, if you like, in the slipstream of the sun. And although it's flying across your screen, if you either imagine it, if you can, or tip your laptop on its side, if you can't, you can see that the planets are actually spinning in a vortex as well. And the other thing that occurs to me about it is that I know that we're vortices of energy. It's said that our bones are renewed every kind of 7 years or so. But it's also true that on a subatomic level, we're being penetrated by subatomic particles all the time and giving off subatomic energy as well. And that includes light. So we're light absorbent entities and we give off photons. And all of that stuff's working as a vortex as well.
And it's just occurred to me to mention an amazing book called Hands of Light by Barbara Brennan. And if you look in that book, you'll see pictures of the human body with illustrations of all the chakras emanating out from the body on both sides of us. For example, the solar plexus is a vortex of energy coming from our solar plexus out into the world and also going into us. And there's a correspondent vortex coming out of our backs as well. So all of our chakras are spinning vortices of energy. I've actually seen this myself, and that was in a dream, but the dream illustrated to me that that's how our chakras work. And it's occurred to me just now that we have coming into our heads another vortex of energy as we have going down into the earth. And that is like a whirlpool, if you like, of which we are the centre, and the vortex is spinning out into the universe from the tops of our heads. So it must be connecting with our pineal, I guess.
Be coming out through the pineal, yeah. And with the auric chakra, which is the one, yeah, that kind of hangs about six, yeah, inches above the head in but some systems.
I'd highly recommend anybody who'd like to see a diagram of that and how it works in Barbara Brennan's book, Hands of Light.
Yeah.
She's drawn some amazing illustrations of that. It's, yeah, quite something to see.
So it seems that that we are kind of in the vortex anyway, that there's not a lot of effort required to do that. Mm. And to a greater or lesser extent, we are expressions of the vortex.
Yeah, and all our chakras spin with a vortical energy, would you say?
That'll do.
Well, vortical energy. Yeah. So, we're very much a part of vortexes. Vortices are very much a part of us.
So let's return to Daniel's stuff and see if we can move towards a bit of advice and help on conscious dreaming as we move towards, you know, later on in the show. We kicked off with his one breath starting at the beginning, and there was no intention, and even after the exhalation and the inhalation, it was nothing and was still nothing. And then there was a catch, and his next, I think this is another really great book, great bit from Daniel's book at the beginning of part two. And he kicks that off again with, and then the catch, this energy, to catch the energy of the first breath and make something. The designers, the dreamers, to take this energy, entirely nothing, entirely free of intention, and use it for something. The possibilities are endless. What would it be like? The dreamers, they came after the initial breath. They came from the breath, but they were different from the pure breath because they had intention. They had big ideas, plans. The original breath is free of care. It does not have any intention. It is the essence of nothing, but the dreamers want to make something of it. What were the first experiments? Half forms, playing. Appearance and disappearance, a hint of possibility, shapes that never quite stick, fluidity, a stream of the consciousness of beginnings, the magicians starting from scratch. What do they learn? Light and darkness, two tones, the one makes the other. Difference and space, continuum, limitation, boundary, form. To keep the image still, they have to concentrate. To hold something in place requires focus. The dreamers learn how to make a decision. They discover time. This is it. Even if it is for a second, a form needs time to exist, or it is lost in the continuum. The more time that is given to the form, the more fixed it can become. The dreamers have to learn to focus. And then they can make something, even if it is only for a second. Concept of time, concept of space, concept of difference. These are the basic starting places of the magicians. And then they get clever. They discover the differences in light. They discover colour. They discover differences in darkness. They discover depth, perspective, spaces within spaces. And then the master stroke. Dr. Rock really likes this one. Volume. The possibility of the third dimension, the object. The object in perspective. So isn't that so much nicer than "in the beginning was the word," and, you know, the Lord God, or was it God made the heavens and the earth? Because that's an expression of a developing principle, isn't it? And we are the extension of those original dreamers, as we'll hear. It's become a little bit more distant from that. But that's the job that we're doing. We're designing and building a world around us. I love the bit that these are the basic starting places of the magicians, and then they get clever. They discover the differences in light. They discover colour. And I think, well, yeah, they did, didn't they? And now we got red, amber and green. We've got blue flashing. We've got all manner of... You see, that's when I read this book, I kind of see things in our outside world that seem to me to be genuine expressions of Daniel's descriptions.
Mm.
He also says that this brings him back to the question of what is real. He says that after that kind of falling away of everything that was familiar and realizing that it was not what he thought it was, he says, "I no longer knew in what to believe. Not only did the education I was receiving become irrelevant, everything seemed irrelevant. I couldn't connect with the conversation. I could no longer connect easily with the context in which people around me were living." Now, that's one of the things that I think is really important about this stuff, because what he's describing there is what's known as shamanic death, the falling away of everything that's familiar, which makes space for something new. But I realised when I read that last little passage that that's what we folks are all going through, because are we not all in a position where we can no longer connect with the conversations that are being held around us, and that it's difficult to connect easily with the context in which people are living? I mean, I find one of the most difficult things is that most people are living in a context of television, which is such a complex instrument of mind control, well, well beyond simply the content that's on it. And as a result, sometimes, quite often, in fact, I find myself in situations where it's not possible to identify or comprehend or actually have any point of contact with what people are saying at all. I mean, we're living in a world where people still think that money is actually a means of paying for something. They don't realise that it's debt. You know, they don't realise, even though it's all over their own televisions, that the banks are laundering these imaginary monies. There's so many things that we have comprehended and understood here that are not common knowledge to the modern Western world. Not yet. I think it's getting there. And so it occurred to me that this is exactly what falling down the rabbit hole is for us. It is us waking up in our own dream. We're waking up in the dream, but this is where we're doing it in the 21st century. These are the terms that we're doing it in. So we already have some of the experience that launched Daniel on Daniel Stone on his journey. We're experiencing very similar things, but they're in our everyday world, and they're forcing us to focus, are they not, guys? They're forcing us to focus on the nature of the thing that's tapping on the front door, apparently, or tapping on the car window, the vehicle window, the machine window, apparently. We're no longer able, as the phrase he uses at some point, which I think we'll hear, is we're no longer able necessarily to take things for granted. Itself a very interesting phrase. And so I guess he's starting to question the authority of the external and look at the quality and the authority of his own internal self. The same sort of realisation as he had when he realised that no matter how many shamans he went to see, looking outside himself for the solution wasn't going to work, and that in the end he was going to find the answers within. And of course, before you can do that, the stuff you think you know has got to fall away, hasn't it? And again, it happened quite suddenly to Daniel, didn't it? Do you remember the story of his...
Yeah, Basically, I think he was at university and he was walking down the street one day, and like you've already said it, really, everything fell away. He had one of those moments where, I think, that does he describe it, or as when in a cartoon, when a character runs out over the cliff and there's quite a while before they actually fall.
Yeah.
And it was like being there, or like you might liken it to a drop of water as it's approaching a waterfall, and then it's suddenly flung away from the river and it has to leap as a drop of water down to the river below. A bit like that.
Yeah.
A complete change of absolutely everything and a falling away of everything.
If I remember rightly, when he is describing that bit, he also says that in the moment before the cartoon character falls, having run off land and into fresh air, at the moment before he falls, there's almost always the moment when he turns and looks at the camera. Oh, you know, in a cartoon, the imaginary camera. But that's looking at the projector.
Yeah, looks at where he's been as well, where he came from, and now he's somewhere completely different.
Yeah. And then he says, our education system tends to focus on the material reality as if the material reality is the only reality. When that is shown to be a lie, one is left floundering. One illusion falls and the others follow in quick succession, like a house of cards. It becomes clear how much is taken for granted. That's where the phrase was. A deeper sensitivity emerges as a result of this. Other energies become more apparent. Feelings, intuitions, hunches that can no longer be ignored. I found more answers in silence, he says.
And I think it says that in the Bible as well, somewhere, doesn't it? In the still, small voice. It was in the stillness that he found the still, small voice of God.
Yeah.
I think it's in there somewhere.
Something like that, yeah.
Something
and
like that.
T.S. Eliot as well, the still point. That is where the dance is.
Yeah.
And I think, again, I was struck by the suddenness of the whole thing falling like a house of cards, because once you fell down the rabbit hole, it does seem to be a gradual education. But I think it seems to me, certainly for many of the people I've spoken to, that there is a moment when it happens. There is a moment when you kind of realise that you can't stop just a little bit of it. As soon as you kind of put the spanner in the spokes, the whole thing comes to a grinding halt. And I know Vin said the same thing. When the audio hits the air conditioning, it's not just a little bit, it's everything, all at once. It's just that the whole thing's been kind of meandering on till then. So again, I see a bit of common experience in what occurs to us and what happened to Daniel. And really, that's exactly it, isn't it? His education system is concentrating on the material and the energetic reality, which is what we're talking about tonight. But our education teaches us absolutely nothing about the world. And it's not until you start realising the illusion, actually get to turn around and look at the camera and realise that it's coming from somewhere, apparently coming from somewhere other than your head, that you get to do anything about it. Do you find any answers in the silence in the desert?
Well, yes. I think, you know, people really need to do that for themselves, I think, rather than me describing any particular answers I might have found. But I don't think it's until you give yourself the space that you have a chance to listen.
Mm.
And it was quite often not silent in the desert, but there was a lot of space, and it enabled you to, I wouldn't want to go into any particular revelations I had, you know. It's just that you give yourself the space to access that.
Yeah, and insight arises.
Yeah.
Interestingly, he expresses that first breath as well in terms of charge, which is another word that I think has been quite heavily abused around us. He says the first breath is an immense charge of energy. And this charge comes from the phenomenal amount of effort it takes to move into separation. Completion has to think into parts of itself. One mind becomes thought, pure thought, and the change is an intense vibration. And the vibration is between thought and the thinker. It's a creative tension. The tension creates fire. And from this creative fire is born the dreamer and the dream. And this is why I'm sure we hear about the original people of Australia talking about the dream time and the dream.
Because I don't think they separated their dream world from their walking about world. I don't think they separated the two.
No. He points out that the first breath creates the simplest basis for all existence, and that's the law of opposites. In order for there to be nothing, there must be something. In order for there to be timelessness, there must be time. In order for completion, there must be incompletion. In order for there to be a thinker, there must be a thought, or perhaps, as well, in order for there to be a thought, there must be a thinker. So this was a huge change, this a huge explosion of energy from one mind to thinker and thought, to difference, to potential, to shades and colours and vibrations and all manner of things. And I really like this idea of the fact that in order for there to be one, there must be the other, because I like to try and feel a bit relaxed about the dark power holders and other such shadow and all these other things that we're forced to contemplate, because I always say that you can't have a stick with only one end, and that, you know, on the other end of the dark power holders stick are the light workers, and that they rely on each other for definition, if for nothing else.
I guess if you bend the stick, you can make a hoop.
Yes. Yes, indeed, yeah. And perhaps that's what we're trying to do. Yeah, that's, I like that, yeah. So we come to this single point meditation, which is so crucial to the kind of generation of things. He talks about, he chose to look at a tree, which of course is something we've spoken about before, with Fred Gillam and with the Ogham sticks and all the rest of it. And see if I can find that. Here it is, yes. His exercise basically is to look at a single point and to concentrate on that for 15 minutes, I think. And there's an exercise we can recommend a little bit later to do that. The thing he decided to concentrate upon was a tree, but it could equally be a wall, it could be anything at all. And I know we've got quite a lot about single point meditation, haven't you? He says, I started to do the exercise focusing on one point on the tree and trying to open my own second sight. I stared at the point for some time. After a while, the point in the tree took me into a dream. I felt as though I was dreaming. I felt as if my physical body was asleep. I came out of the point and saw the tree as if I was dreaming it. On the outside, nothing physically had changed. I was still on the ground, leaning against a tree, looking in the same direction. The difference was that I was looking at the tree as if the tree was being dreamed. After a while, colours and sounds evolved. The colours were related to the sounds. I couldn't understand the sounds in words through my intellect, but I knew that the tree was communicating to me in some way. I came out of the tree and I understood more than ever before that as much as I was dreaming the tree was dreaming me.
Yeah, lovely.
And that's the process, really. I think as human beings, we've got something of a problem with the idea that anything other than humans can be conscious or self-aware. I find it absolutely amazing how dismissive we are of the entities that we find around us. And I know you talk about meeting with trees.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do some of that in the desert?
We did indeed. We did indeed. I've worked with trees again for some time, but we did spend, everybody adopted a tree, if you like, in the desert. And we had our own tree, not our tree, but the tree that we used to go to. And we spent a whole day with our tree once. We went out soon after dawn and spent all day with the tree and came back some people after it had got dark. And the task in hand, basically, was to tune in to what Daniel's just been describing, actually, because probably inspired by his own activity there, was to realise that the tree was a part of our dream and that we were a part of the tree's dream, and that this was a communication we were having rather than just us experiencing a tree.
Yeah.
It was a reciprocal communication that was happening.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody had different experiences because we're all different. But the basic task was that.
And the experience of the tree basically, again, is arising from the truth of each individual that's doing the exercise.
Yeah, we were communicating as individuals.
Yeah.
Because that tree, although they were all related, the trees in the desert were all the same kind of acacia tree, we were communicating, relating to a particular tree in that network of trees.
What did you bring out of that?
Well, I mean, I was there all day, yeah. So it was a long experience, yeah. You know, yeah. It was a long time. And again, practicing the 1-point meditation, focusing on a particular part of a leaf or a particular stick on the ground by the tree, spent time hanging. We had hammocks, which was great. So we asked the tree, hang up a hammock in the tree, and we hung around in the hammock for hours. I carved a piece of wood into a spiral, which took hours. Again, you know, I mean, I was totally with that tree for the whole day. And I coloured the spiral of wood that I carved with some green from one of the leaves on the tree, some yellow mud from the ground underneath the tree. And actually, it might sound a bit strange, but I cut myself accidentally while I was carving the spiral. So my blood actually formed a red on this spiral stick that I carved. I actually left it in the desert. I didn't bring it back with me. I gave it to Daniel, and it's probably still around, kicking around there somewhere. But it was an absorbing activity. Like, we don't normally get to spend a day with a tree, whole day. And we were out there for the day. That was it. That was our activity for the day. So,
and didn't you end up drawing some conclusions about connectedness of the trees?
Yes. Well, that was a bit later on when we went to the... I had that experience in the woodland that we went to visit, where we were all sent out into this beautiful pine forest with lots of lovely wildflowers and birds and all the rest of it. And I went to sit with this pine tree, and I noticed that where the drip line of the tree ended, where the edge of the tree was, if you like, there were lots of little pine tree seedlings growing all around in a circle, getting ready for when the time that pine tree died to take over and become new pine trees. And I had this strong sense of a community, not just of the tree and its community where it was standing, but that the tree knew its place in the forest, knew its place where it was standing, also knew its place in the forest, and extend that around the globe, really, that tree knew its place on the planet and beyond, probably.
Yeah.
Who are we to limit a tree to the ground it's standing in,
If that's true of a tree, how much more so is it possibly true of the kind of energetic structures that make us up?
Yeah, of course. So it was a strong sense of community and this awareness, because a lot of people don't know their place. I don't mean you don't know when to shut up, but
a lot of people don't know that. Don't know.
But they, you know, a lot of people don't know that we have a place in the universe, even, or give it the time to discover that.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, the trees, because I remember hearing about an experiment that somebody did where they they decided they were going to attach electrodes to an office plant of some sort, and then take a Zippo lighter to it to see whether the plant reacted to anthropomorphize it, we'd call it pain, see whether there was any chemical or electrical, well, specifically in this case, electrical response from the plant, and indeed there was. And I think it was also discovered that it wasn't only that plant that responded in a shock fashion, but other plants in the office also were found to be registering responses to what was being done.
Wonderful.
And even more remarkable was the fact that leaving the electrodes on the plants, the guy kind of who'd done all of that disappeared and came back at another point, and all of the plants kind of, they responded just to the presence of the individual who'd been responsible for doing this to them.
Well, I've heard, I think it's true, that they use plants at entrances to banks and such like buildings with sensors on them, and these sensors can actually detect the emotion of the person who's walking into the bank.
Really?
So if they're stressed or afraid or angry or any of those kind of strong emotions, the plant will register them.
Blimey, you're telling me the plant had joined the Stasi?
Well, we're attaching electrodes to the plant to access its awareness.
I think the thing about this is that, I mean, it's a bit of an example because Daniel chose a tree to concentrate on for his first single point meditation, which led to him having intuitions and sensing sounds and colours and realising that not only was he dreaming the tree, which is quite important, because most people do assume that when you look out and see a tree, that what you're seeing, again, in our materialist mindset, what you're seeing is a thing that grows there, which, you know, to a certain extent you are. But he realised that he was dreaming the tree.
Yeah.
And then he realised that the tree was dreaming him.
Yeah.
Which I think is really brilliant. And it reminded me again of that basic fundamental quantum physics experiment where people were firing photons of light through a single slit and through a double slit. And it seems that the photons respond to the attention of an observer.
Mm.
And again, you realise that the tree is kind of made up of light. The tree is stored light, everything is energetic pattern. And so if this double slit experiment, if this strange behaviour of light, and it is very strange, in fact, I will just reach again for Serena's book. I've read about the double slit experiment many, many times, and a lot of it kind of sticks in, a lot of it goes away. Things like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, Schrodinger's cat, the double slit experiment, they're just so weird that even though I've read about them many, many times in many places, I do find it extremely difficult to remember. But in Serena's book, and did I mention that Serena's going to be on the show next week? Oh, I did, that's all right then. she describes it, I think, really beautifully. She says, if there is an emitter of electrons or photons and it sends out a beam through a single slit, then they will behave like particles so that on the screen behind the slit, you get a straight line. However, you send the beam through two slits, they will behave like a wave and you get an interference pattern of a strong line in the middle with weaker and weaker lines going out to each side. But in the double slit experiment, if you send electrons one at a time, when by all accounts they shouldn't be able to interfere with one another to give an interference pattern, you still get an interference pattern, even though there's no other electron for it to interfere with. This means that the electron is splitting itself into two and interfering with itself. But, and this is even stranger, mathematically and experimentally, it's going through both slits, neither slit, one or the other slit, and none of those things is actually happening. So that's strange enough, isn't it? That there's no real understanding on this, on the material level. There's no real understanding of what's going on there. In that all three things are happening at once and none of them are happening. But it gets even stranger in connection with the observing of the tree. If you put an observer, a measuring device of some sort, by the slit, then that affects the results, and the electrons behave like particles. The observation causes the electron to act differently, or the photon, as if it was aware of being watched. The observer, as the phrase goes, collapses the wave function simply by observing. In other words, the electron is both particle and wave in all possible states until it is observed, and the act of observation is called collapsing the wave function. What we choose to examine it with changes the property of what is out there. Consciousness must be involved and is more fundamental than matter. There are two laws. One applies when you're not looking, one applies when you're looking. Looking at things involves interacting with them. We influence the observed. There is no separability. It's all created by consciousness. Observer, observed, and the process of observation. So that's really a way of saying about the about that particular experiment. It's similar to Daniel's phrase that we're dreaming the tree and the tree's dreaming us.
Very much so.
Which I think is really exciting because it's quite difficult from our well-trained and well-indoctrinated view to imagine that a tree's looking back at us.
Mm.
But since I heard about it, I've tried that. And you can. It's great to spend some time looking at a tree and do that with it, and then spend some time feeling that the tree's looking back at you.
Yeah, it's a communication. That, I suppose it's like learning a language, you could say, because if you go to another country and you can't speak the language, then you find it difficult to communicate. And as you learn the language, you learn how to communicate with people, although an awful lot can be done with sign language. It can get you into some sticky corners.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and again, the idea that a tree might respond to observation, let alone that it might be dreaming us, is completely alien to most of us. So
the one point.
Yeah.
We're going back there.
Yeah. The one-point meditation. This is part of the... remember that the dreamers in the last section, in the section that we started this little bit of the show with, had intention, whereas there was no intention in the first breath. And it brings us to the actual act of seeing, to what's going on. And Daniel divides it into four bits, and this is one of the things you've done lots of, isn't it? The one-point meditation is made up of four parts. If we imagine it as a circle, and if we imagine ourselves travelling clockwise around the circle, in the north, we've got the act of the intent to see, which is effectively opening the dreamer's eyes. And then in the east, we've got the act of projecting, which he describes as the process of design. And then in the south, we've got the act of being seen, which is holding the object in time and space, which, as we heard, takes a whole load of energy. And then finally, the act of releasing. And do you recognise that from your practice of the meditation?
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, what Daniel describes that you do is... and I've been practicing with this now for a couple of years at least, probably more, is, for example, if you sit down on a patch of grass, like a lawn or any patch of grass, really, sit down and find something to focus on that isn't moving. So a little stone or something that isn't moving, which is somewhere around the centre of your vision. And you focus on that entirely until some extraordinary things happen. And you'll experience these for yourselves if you try it out. And I highly recommend trying it out if you've not done it. What happens is you've got the intent to see initially, because you have to focus really intently on that point. And then what happens, it's amazing, it's like the opposite of one of those 3D pictures that you look at. You start in the 2D and go into the 3D. Well, what happens for me is you start with the 3D world and bring it into the 2D. That's the best way I can describe it. So if you're looking at a point in the centre of a large piece of grass, it becomes one thing. And you can do this with mountains, trees. I've done it. It's a really interesting exercise to do. If you're sitting by a stream, as I was last summer, sitting by a beautiful little Welsh stream, the sun was shining and the insects were doing their amazing dance over the stream, I focused on a point on the other side of the stream. And what I could see, and I'd never seen it before, was the insects were leaving trails in the sky like a myriad infinity symbols all being woven by these insects. Because normally you just see the insects moving around.
And your eyes are picking them out, aren't they, as they flick around?
When you look at a point on the other side of the stream, you can see all these trails they're leading, and you can see the form that their dance is taking, which I'd never seen before, and that's quite amazing.
So you're basically there dropping the focus on individual items,
yeah,
and catching a bit more of the energy of them, and as a result they're losing something of their form.
Yeah.
And this practice, the final part of it, this act of releasing, is a relief from the effort of attention. But he also allies it with the necessity to blink.
Yeah. Well, I do find that the more I do this, that the less I need to blink. And even if you do need to blink when you're taking part in this cycle, then you can go straight back to your focus and it doesn't take long to get back into the design stage again, if you like.
Yeah.
You can tune straight back in. In fact, I would liken that to trying to remember a dream.
Yeah.
I would liken that to that point because you're going back into your previous image.
Yeah.
You can lose it for a second if you have to blink, and then you can go straight back into it.
Mm-hmm. And by practicing that, you're improving your ability to get back into your dreams.
Yeah.
As you come out of them.
Yeah.
Given certain parameters.
It's the same process, I think.
Yeah.
And also, I find as well that the less often I need to blink.
Yeah.
The more focused I can become on that single point, the less often I need to blink. I wouldn't say I could go for 15 minutes because I think we have a physical need to blink, and it's also part of the cycle of releasing.
Yeah.
And then
he says that that releasing has to occur because the effort needed to sustain attention, even for a millisecond, is enormous. Well, actually, I suppose that's true when you think of the amount of energy there is keeping the eyes and the attention going for that.
You do have to work at this to get it to slip into that amazing 2D world that's the best way I can describe it, where the whole image in front of you, whatever you're looking at, becomes a flat screen.
Yeah.
That's what, and you can see the patterns in whatever it is you're looking at.
And he's describing this as a thought vibration.
There you go.
Yeah, a world made up as a thought vibration. And as soon as your eyes stop skipping over the surface of it and focusing on things and holding them in place, then the stuff around the point of concentration dissolves into pattern. Mm.
It's just like coming out of one of those 3D pictures.
Yeah.
But it's a bit like going into one at the same time.
Yeah.
It's doing both of those things, I think.
Of course, that idea that the universe is made of a thought vibration is an old idea, isn't it? It's the foundation of that Buddhist science of the mind, Daniel says. The idea of the dreamers being the designers of the universe comes from the Australian and Aboriginal perspective as well as from the shamanic traditions of the Americas. Dreamers are the magicians who spin the cosmic web. And as dreamers, that's one of the things that we're doing.
Yeah, and we're going to get into dreaming a little bit more, aren't we? But through becoming more conscious of the dream time, which is, I think, what we slip into in the single point meditation or the one point meditation. Yeah. We're slipping into the dream time. And the more we can do that in our walking hours, our waking hours, then the more we'll be able to take part in the creation of our dreams.
Yeah, which is what we're after doing.
Because they're totally interrelated. Yeah. So slipping into this one-point meditation is a way to access the dream time in our waking hours.
And as he says, the cosmic web is the thread between all the realities in the one mind. So we have that single exhalation and an inhalation, the creator of the thinker, and at that point the dreamers came into existence as well, and they had intention and plans. He says the initial dreamers were in touch with the first breath to the extent that they were able to see everything in the context of the whole, because they were still close to the one mind. But as the process of separation developed, the dreams within dreams within dreams, the perspective of the one mind was lost. And Daniel says that it's the belief of almost every elder and teacher that he's met that the human dream has lost contact with the rest. And this is the root of human loneliness, the isolated dream. And I'd say that some of the awakening that we're experiencing now, becoming alert to the nature of the dream in which we're living, is the first movement back to the rest of the dreams. I think we are bringing the human dream back towards the one mind, and hopefully, well, it seems likely that that's going to help us deal, resolve the loneliness, because we need to resolve the isolation of the human dream.
Yeah. Well, not only does breath connect us all, but dreams do too, because when we slip into the dream time, we're slipping into the, what Jung called the collective unconscious. Mm. There is no separation in there. And that's how you can be visited in your dreams by other people's dream bodies. Whether they're aware of it or not, their dream body is visiting you. And that can be developed as a skill. You can actually develop the skill of the dream body traveling and visiting.
Yeah. Well, the idea of the collective unconscious takes us back to the Serena quote about the subliminal mind.
That's right.
Having access to everything that ever was, is, or shall be.
Because Jung describes it as our waking hours or walking hours, I quite like. Mm. But we're like islands in a sea. So that when we're awake, we're on the island. And when we sleep, we go into the sea, which is global, possibly universal, sea of the collective unconscious.
Yeah.
And there is no, like I say, there's no separation in there. We're all connected in there.
Yeah. So what we're saying is there's a degree of work and persistence and consistency involved in developing access to these things, using first of all the breath meditation, yeah, and then the one point meditation. But what we're doing there is stripping away the distraction and all of the other things and working our way towards it in what in the West we think is our conscious state, although I know that there's a lot of Eastern mystics who'd say that we're actually at our least conscious when we're awake. But what we're saying is that when we're asleep, we are far closer to that unconscious state, far closer to the collective unconscious, far closer to the point where we can access all of this stuff that is apparently retained by the subliminal mind. And that is why we're particularly interested in becoming conscious dreamers,
mm-hmm,
is because there we are the creators. There we're dealing with a world that's entirely energetic. I mean, the things we see in our dreams, some of them are really quite real. Some of them are so bizarre, mm-hmm, that if we were to see them in our waking life, well, we wouldn't, because we wouldn't believe it if we did. But we can see them and believe them in our dreams. And that means that we can experiment with this energetic creative process more easily in our dreams than in the waking.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that, I suppose in a way, that's where we can get our practice in. Well, I've heard that you become closest to consciousness in your dream state.
Mm-hmm.
In your deep dream state is where you are closest to consciousness. So we're accessing consciousness in our dreams, in our dream state, or in the dream time. That's where we're closest to it. So if we're closest to consciousness in our dream state, that's where we can develop our consciousness.
Yeah.
I suppose is what I'm saying. And there's all sorts of ways of doing that.
Yeah, well, I suppose that if we, the thing is that if we if we have experience of this at night, and I know that Serena's going to introduce a whole new aspect to this, because one of her areas of research has been into the melatonin and serotonin cycles, which produce DMT in the pineal, which is the surfboard, if you like, on which we dream. So there's a lot of other stuff happening there, but that's to do with the actual creation of the dream state. But if we learn to wake up to ourselves in our dreams and take some sort of control over those, it is inevitably going to lead to more control of the everyday waking dreams.
Well, that's right. I'm beginning to realise, like I say, that they are inseparable. But there's all sorts of things we can do in our awake lives to assist the development of our dream time, if you like, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, we've talked about all sorts of ways, like, for instance, going to bed early is one of them.
Yeah.
And we won't be doing that tonight. Mm. But, you know, if you can get to bed by 9 o'clock, and I know a lot of people find many reasons why they can't do that, but if you can get to bed by 9 o'clock and be well asleep by 10, then your most valuable healing time is between 10 and 12 midnight. That's when a lot of these hormones are produced.
Mm.
The DMT,
melatonin,
the other tryptamines.
Yeah, because you've got a whole stable of them. It's not just DMT.
Yeah.
We make loads of different sorts of tea.
And we really do have to be asleep for those things to happen.
And in a dark room.
And preferably in a dark room.
Serena says, not a chink of light.
There you go. Not a chink of light. So dark room, early bed, nice and warm, hopefully. And then you have more of a chance then of giving yourself time to do your healing work, which is what the body does when it's asleep.
Yeah.
Produce all these lovely hormones, and the DMT that we produce in our pineals, in our very own pineals, we're making our own DMT, gives us access to the dream time.
Mm.
And as we become more aware of that and more conscious of that, gives us access to becoming conscious in our dreams, which, as I've said, is inseparable.
How do you know when you're conscious in a dream then?
Well, there's all sorts of tips I've been given over the years, and I think when they were first mentioned, I didn't think much of them. But there are things like, if you can see your own hands or your own feet in a dream, then I guess you walk with your feet and you do things with your hands. So I will quite often, very, very often, be very aware of either my feet or my hands in my dream, sometimes both. My hand will be holding something that I'm looking at intently. My feet will be walking on something that I can feel, like sand. Or recently I had an interesting dream. I was walking on water.
Really?
Yeah. And my feet could feel, I was watching my feet as I was walking on water, and I could feel the water flowing underneath my feet, which was wonderful. So I think that's a good tip. If you can become aware of your hands, I've never done it, intentionally.
Mm.
It's always just happened in my
dream. It was one of the recommendations in Castaneda's Don Juan books, wasn't it? That was one of the first things he said, was that if you can become aware that you're seeing your own hand, if you're aware that that's what's happening, then you are awake in
that's
the dream.
That's it. And then, I mean, once you've seen your own hands or your own feet and experienced them doing something in your dream, I think you're there, basically. And then it's up to you to, you can make conscious choices in your dreams, because you're creating, you're the filmmaker, you're creating the film. I'm not saying that it is totally of your creation. I'd rather say you're participating in the creation of your dream, because you're accessing the dream time, which is beyond culture, beyond boundary.
Beyond physics, beyond, material control.
Beyond physicality. Mm. So you're accessing that. So then you're communicating with prime consciousness, I suppose, or what do you call it? The one mind?
There's also this business, isn't there, of not letting your eyes stop on any given point in the dream, actually moving them around.
Well, that doesn't necessarily apply, because I do sometimes focus intently on one thing in my dream, perhaps a crystal I'm holding in my hand. Mm. I can look at it for what seems like ages in the dream. And another point about that, if you wake up from a dream and you want to go back there or you want to remember it, if you don't open your eyes, it's very helpful. And also, if you can remember something from your dream and think about it quite hard, that can help you to access either the dream again so that you can re-enter it, or access the memory of the dream. So that you can, so in a way it's a kind of one point meditation in your dream. And then to get back into it, you can use the same technique. Anything you might remember that you dreamt about, a crystal. Thinking about that crystal will bring it back.
I became conscious in a dream the other night simply because I actually in the dream I was apparently having a bath. And I know that I don't really get, you know, we get access to quite a lot of showers, but baths are a really rare luxury nowadays. And there was something in my head that was going, oh, well, this can't be right, because I know I don't see baths very often. And I did actually awake in the dream, because normally I'm just a kind of disembodied consciousness in my dreams. I don't tend to see my hands and feet. But that was the first time I actually remember that happening. So perhaps this work's starting to pay off.
I think so. That's quite a physical dream, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because your body also was thinking of having a bath.
And your dream body doesn't need a bath.
No.
So what was it doing in there?
Well, it might.
Yeah.
You can go swimming in your dreams.
It's true, yeah, I suppose so.
Maybe not to get clean, but, you know.
Oh, I'd be really shocked if I found myself swimming. I'd really know I was dreaming then.
Well, people...
not because I can't swim, but just because I don't.
And flying, of course. There's another famous one. If you can... I've flown many times in my dreams, and sometimes in contraptions of some kind, or sometimes just me flying, and I can go where I want to go.
That was one of Daniel's favourites as well. He says that each time he finds himself flying, he tries to do something new, like loop the loop or change the altitude or change the speed, slowly but surely, progressively exercising his will on the dream state.
You can also see in those kind of dreams, I think you can see the effect of that your awake time is having on your dream. So your flying might be more, you might have more volition if you'd had a good day than you would have maybe if you hadn't had such a good day.
Mm-hmm.
You might not be able to fly so high or guide the flight quite so much. So... The quality of your flying is reflecting.
Yeah. It's also good, isn't it, not to have to be woken up by an alarm clock.
Yeah. Alarms don't work very well, because you want to be able to, when you're waking from a dream, whether it's in the middle of the night or in the morning, you really, somebody said to me once, you don't look out the window, because if you look out of the window, then your dream will fly out of the window. And this seems to be very true. If you can keep your eyes closed, and, like we said, focus on something from your dream.
Yeah.
It can help you to access it, re-access it.
Yeah, very good. Well, we'll have a look before the end of the show. We'll have a look at a couple of meditations that help us practice for that kind of focus in the dream. I like that Daniel says that we live in this constant illusion as if everything is fixed and everything's secure. And as he points out, you know, it's all bloody spinning around out there. You might be sitting looking at the wall. You seem to be still. Everything's quiet. The wall seems to be still. But the planet's spinning. You know, the Earth's spinning. It's kind of rotating in its own kind of traily spiral form behind the sun. It's actually part of a galaxy that's spinning as well. But we have this amazing illusion that everything's fixed and everything is secure. Again, part of our cultural conditioning, this sort of thing is not true all over the world. He says we believe that a rock is a rock, a spade is a spade. And he says this is the work of eons of focused dreaming. The dreamers have mastered the art of fixed attention with such incredible impeccability.
Mm.
It's hard for us to believe that the root of it all is free form of random movement.
Mm.
And not only on the macro scale, as just described, but also the thing is that on the subatomic level, it's all probabilistic. None of it's being determined. Everything's whizzing around at a hell of a rate. Just a vast expression of energy with actually hardly any matter there at all. It's nearly all space.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of somebody, I was talking to somebody recently and they were saying, we were agreeing basically that we are, each of us is the centre of our own universe. We are at the centre of the whirlpool. And that when we feel that we're sitting still, looking at a single point, then that is the still point of which we are the centre. That's what you're doing there, I think, is tuning into the fact that we are the still point. We're the dancers, as T.S. Eliot says. Interestingly, the still point is where the movement will occur.
Yeah, and everything else dissolves around that point.
Mm.
I like using a candle myself, because although the flame moves, if you look at the base of the flame, where it meets the candle, that stays still.
Yeah.
And that gives you... you can see forms changing there.
Yeah.
It's also, it's not just our dream, is it? I think, again, it's a really lovely passage where he says, consider your own dream and how your dream is influenced by the dreams of others. The dream of your mother, the dream of your father, dreams of your brothers, sisters, your friends, partners, lovers, teachers. Dream of the school, college, colleagues, neighbours. Dream of your boss, your government, television dreams, newspapers, radio, theatre, film, books. Dream of the whole of your culture, your nation state, the dreams of this century, dreams of previous centuries. Dream of the earth, dream of the solar system, dream of the galaxy, dream of the universe. So many dreams and so many dreamers trying to influence you. It's a wonder you can remember anything at all. And you're...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think... developing the consciousness in our dreaming, or getting closer to consciousness in our dreaming, enables us to free ourselves from a lot of what you've just described.
Yeah.
Because it is a sea that we are entering in the dream time. It connects all dreamers.
Yeah.
Are in that sea. So
like a vast offline role-playing game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And as he points out, you know, because you've got, not only are we living in the world that is actually physically very, very active and energetic, but you've also got all these other dreams affecting you.
Yeah.
You know, and when you go out, when you went out to the desert, or when you enter a breath meditation, or however it is we're choosing to shed the baggage, as it were, you've still got all this stuff. It's in your consciousness. You're not going to forget it because it's been put there. And as Serena says, you know, we potentially know it all. We retain it all in some sense. Mm. So he says that for all of these reasons, the one-point meditation is phenomenally difficult, but not impossible. It's the first step in training yourself to be conscious in your own dream. So just like it's kind of hard for us to get focus on the breath, although that is well achievable for many people, more achievable sometimes than it is at others, but I think it's achievable for all of us sometimes. so long as we have the persistence and consistency in practice. As he points out, almost everyone is unconscious of the forces that dream him or her. They are like walk-on extras in a film, who are only told what to do for their specific moment in the crowd scene, and are not shown the rest of the script. And again, I see a real common point there with our challenges with the law and with money and with all that sort of stuff. There's been a completely different story written by that author, Itty, than there is being written by ours. So it is like we're not being shown the rest of the script, but we are discovering it. And he says, the conscious dreamer moved towards an awareness which not only shows them the script of the film in which they are acting, but also the script writer, musicians, costume designer, stage manager and promoter. The conscious dreamer actually becomes the co-creator and co-writer of their own dream.
Yeah, that's it. I love the fact that he's used the word co-creator and co-writer, because we're part of the creation. We are not the creation of our dreams. We're accessing, as Serena says, that subliminal
mind
which has unlimited potential.
All of the subliminal mind sprung from that first exhalation, that first inhalation, and one mind.
Yeah.
It is, as we say, all one thing pretending to be many and taking itself seriously.
Yeah.
And that's what we're playing in. Well, I'm going to play another couple of tunes before we come back with some final thoughts on one or two things that we might choose to exercise our single point meditation on, because there's some things that are a lot more fun than others, and one or two other meditations that people might investigate productively once they've kind of mastered breathing. I've only been here 52 years and here I am still trying to master the breathing. So what we'll do is we'll put on a couple of tunes. We'll try and turn off the microphone as well so you don't hear us prattling over the top. And we'll probably be back with you in, looks like, 10 minutes or so. And in memory of the last cock-up on the microphone, here's Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths. And all talk, no action, and apologies from your amateur DJ.
This is Media Streaming International Radio.
I love that comment in the chat box. I have managed to scroll back up and I'll just do that, actually. It's my dream and you're all in it. I think that's a fair statement for all of us. Like we say, like a massive offline role-playing game of some sort. Mahatma Coate has put in a question which we get asked quite a lot, actually, which is, what if you don't dream? Well, the thing is, apparently we all do dream. It's just that the circumstances are not always created, Mahat, for us to remember those dreams. Some of Masses come up with then give up the weed, Mahat. Important, that one as well. Because the thing is that if we're going to bed really late, so that we spend our time, so that we fall straight into a deep sleep. I always used to put it as like sleeping like a dead man and then suddenly waking up with the alarm clock and needing to get your shit together and go and do whatever it is that needs to be done. Then there isn't the space to remember the dreams, but we can do some things to help us remember our dreams, can't we?
We can indeed. And I've been experimenting with this myself over the years. And one of the things I know we can do, and I hate to call them intoxicants, but that's what they are. And the fewer of those we can have before we go to sleep, then the more likely we are to, and the time we go to bed as well is important, the more likely we are to, A, remember our dreams, especially if we give ourselves a bit of time to come out of them, but also to become conscious in our dreams.
And it does have to be said that that cannabis is a really good way of suppressing dreams.
Yes, I know. I know some people who are regular cannabis smokers, and they, as a group, experienced when they didn't have any, they all had the most horrific nightmares for quite a few nights, And this is quite interesting, I think, because they would need to go through a spell of that before they could start accessing any kind of conscious dreaming, because they were inhibiting their ability by their habits. And I would include myself in this. I've been looking at it recently myself, and I know for sure that, like I say, the fewer intoxicants I'd include, tea, coffee, alcohol, cannabis.
I really know that, it's been a while since we've had anything to smoke, but I do know that in the days when I was drifting in and out of it, that my dreams I did find were really quite, quite graphic and coherent and memorable. Again, Mahat says that he hasn't had a dream in over 15 years. I think that you'd probably find that if they were to stick you in a sleep laboratory and wire you up, that you are dreaming, but you're just not remembering it.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like our physical body apparently is going through a huge repair mechanism when we're asleep, and so much so that it apparently has mechanisms within it that kind of paralyze it whilst that's happening, because otherwise it'd be thrashing around in response to all the work it's doing. The thing is that we're doing mental, that's the physical material side of it, as our own personal vortex maintains itself, gets itself ready for the next day. Our consciousness, subconsciousness, whatever it is, our mind, our awareness is working on similar things. I mean, I remember this happening to me when I was working in industry, and I was under quite a lot of pressure and responsible for quite a lot of things. And I was shattered all the time. I really, really did just literally, I'd fall asleep more or less as soon as I got home. And I remember I used to wake up in the middle of the night, more or less sitting bolt upright in bed and sweating, thinking, 1, 2, 7, 8, 3 support straps. And when I got back into work the next morning, I'd find that the big order that I'm shepherding through all of these bleeding workshops, and for which I'm responsible for the parts, that was the one thing that I hadn't ordered. I hadn't ordered the strap to hold the whole assembly to the wall. So I knew way back then that things were happening at night. Now, I didn't remember any dreams or anything. The only thing I had at that point was waking up and remembering that I hadn't done something. And then finding out, lo and behold, when I got back into my place of slavery, that it was right. But I think the most invigorating experience I had was when I went on that science, matter and consciousness course. And after a couple of pints of old Rosie in the bar, one of my fellow course attendees gave me a bit of a challenge. We'd had one the night before. We'd been set a bit of a riddle to sort out. And most of us did actually come up with the answer. But this one really interested me, because what this guy said was, just as we were on our way to bed, he said, I'm going to give you the first in a finite series of letters, and I'd like you to tell me what the next letters are tomorrow morning. And the letters he gave me were O-F-W-A-I-H. That's what he said. And he said they were the first 6 letters in a finite series. And I went to bed, and what we've been given was another tip, and this is one that Serena recommends as well, is that we have something that we do to make ourselves remember our dreams. He said it didn't really matter what it, the teacher said it didn't matter what it was. You could tap yourself on the knee or the elbow or the head and go, I will remember my dreams. And if there's something you particularly want to know or something you particularly want to sort out, then you bring that to mind as well. So that's what I did. I did what had worked for me the previous night, was I tapped myself on both knees, said, I am going to remember my dreams. I am going to find the solution to this riddle. And I had the most crazy dream. I used to have a lot of dreams being chased around. Doesn't happen anymore. But in this occasion, I was being chased around what looked like a town. But after a fair while of running about, I realised that it wasn't a town, that it was like a movie lot, and that all of the buildings and everything were simply made out of board, and they were propped up from behind. And the people that were chasing me appeared to be Nazis. They were kind of wearing Nazi uniforms and all that kind of stuff, which is one of the reasons why I was running so hard. But when they caught up with me, it turned out that they were about as real as the buildings were, that they were just guys dressed up as Nazis and that somehow they were playing a part. And I realised this, so in the end, they only pretended to torture me and I pretended to scream. And there was some kind of pretend vicar standing next to me whilst these final stages were going on. And the only genuine thing in the dream, the only thing that was recognisable from the workaday world, was the prayer that the priest was saying. And the prayer was, "Our Father which art in heaven," OFWAIH. So that was a really clear example to me. And I've pulled that stunt many times since. I've sorted out some quite difficult things. Nibiru says in there, he says, weed always gets the blame. I quite agree. And mostly, I'm a huge supporter of the stuff myself. I find it extremely creative and useful, especially first thing in the morning. But there's no doubt in my mind that it definitely suppresses my ability to remember my dreams. But he says that he dreams all night. Ah, practice. Right. Send me your secret, Nibiru. That's the one I want. Some of us are saying, this is a dream, Mahat. Yeah. Dream about everything. Very good. Fat men in ladies' undies, says some of us. I love it. You're off there now, aren't you? So, what I'd like to do is just have a quick look in a bit more, just at some of the subjects that might be used for this single point, this single point meditation, because it is really the key to where the man goes next. And it is my hope to perhaps carry on this conversation in future shows. And also in the next few shows, one way or the other, we are going to be finding ourselves talking to people who might be called shamanic practitioners, to people who've done research into psi and all of that. So this is, if you like, to provide a bit of a background to that, as well as to provide a kind of launching point. Because it seems to me that there's a lot of the common nature of Daniel Stone's experiences in his falling into his shamanic lifestyle and his conscious dreaming are so similar to the experiences that we're having as we encounter the true nature of the administrative world that we're finding ourselves in. So the single point meditation starts with, as with most meditations in my experience, which is spending 10 or 15 minutes tuning into your breath, because that, as we discussed earlier, involves, if you like, shaking off the influences of the day, moving yourself a little bit further away from the dream of your culture, the dream of the television, the dream of whatever else it is that's been keeping your mind busy during the day. And then after sort of 10 or 15 minutes, we can choose something like focusing on a point on the wall or an object in front of you. I personally find it easier to have an object. I don't know about you. Focusing on a point on the wall, I think, is quite difficult. I like to use a candle flame. Crystals, good. Flower. Concentrating on a flower is really great.
If you look at a wall, or like I say, a lawn of grass, you can find a point. You look at any wall, there's hardly a perfect wall without a little black speck on it somewhere or something. That's all you need, is a single thing to pick out, something, preferably something that doesn't move.
Yeah, okay. He says keep your attention fixed on that point for at least 15 minutes. Mm. And this will help you to stabilise your breath and your attention so that you become less distracted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of deepening of the breath meditation, isn't it?
It is.
Because I guess your mind's kind of concentrating on your breath and the breathing in and out just easily. There's no need to do anything to the breath. And you're actually occupying your senses by looking at a point on the wall, or your main sense, because we mostly rely on sight, although we use hearing and smell and all the rest of it.
Well, another thing Daniel recommends doing with this meditation, I think, in fact, it comes first, is developing the ability to be able to close your eyes.
Well, that's what he says now.
And focus
Having focused on the wall, he says, focus on a point and close your eyes. Focus on a point inside your vision, which is more difficult, which it is, because the stuff in there moves about.
That's it. So keeping that still, keeping a single point with your eyes closed, is quite difficult, but it's worth persevering with.
Mm. And he says, be patient with yourself, as with the other meditation. This isn't easy. which it isn't, but it's a lot of fun. And with practice, you'll begin to learn how to fix your attention.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing that I find really useful to meditate on, and this is another exercise that he gives us in broadly the same place, is to focus on a bit of geometry. And he says that one of the most fundamental geometries we've got is the triangle.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first, if you like, physical form. It's a plane, it's only 2D, so it's not a 3D form, and we're not going to have time to get into the third dimension this time round. Been prattling on. But he points out that in the yantric tradition of the Hindus, the universe begins with one point, which is called Bindi. And we can imagine that as the one mind holding its breath, ready to exhale, because unlike us, it exhales first. We come into this world, the first thing we do is breathe in, and when we go out of this world, the last thing we do is breathe out.
Mm-hmm.
But the one mind did it the other way around. So Bindi, the one mind. Then the creator dancer, Shiva, stretches out his arm in a line. The line finds a second point, Shakti. Together they find the third point in the universe, their creation. The result is the first solid form, the triangle. And one of the talks that I do on geometry starts from that single point, which is the monad, the one mind, the single perfect thing, where there's no difference, there's no distinction, no colour, no light, no nothing, no before, no after, no up, no down, none of those distinctions, none of the paradoxes that we started with at the very beginning of the show. But what's imagined in geometry is that the monad is the circle, because the circle is an infinite thing, because the circumference of a circle is defined by pi, which is an irrational number which goes on forever and ever. Even though we can draw a complete circle, we can never actually put a value on it. So that's why the circle was picked as an imagination, as an imagining, if you like, of this infinite entity, this one mind. And what's imagined for the creation, for that one breath, for the exhalation in geometric terms, is that the circle has a given circumference, and that the consciousness that's in the centre of it, and all over it, in fact, because the boundaries are everywhere and the centre is nowhere, is that it moves to the boundary of this circle and draws another circle of the same size. And that is the stretching out of the arm of Shiva, if you like, because suddenly we've got length. Suddenly we've got, where we had just one perfect thing before, now we've got a thinker and a thought, because there's still only one thinker. And this shape of two interlaced circles is exactly what happens at cell fertilization and division. When cells divide, that's how they do it. It makes a shape in the middle that's a bit like a flower petal. It's a bit like a two-dimensional rugby ball. And it's said that from that springs all of geometry. And it is from that one moment that it happens, that one inhalation, exhalation and inhalation. That's the point from which all of reality springs. And here they say that together, Shiva and Shakti, as they name them, find the third point, which is their creation. I like to say that once these things have moved, once this thing has moved, there is an I and a you, and therefore there's a we. Or there's now an over here and an over there. There is a before and an after. So all of those things springing into life are a kind of memory, if you like, of that original exhalation that we're seeking to reattain access to, because it's not that we haven't got access to it, it's that we are so distracted and so busy and so otherwise engaged that we fail to make use of this, one of our most fundamental tools. And the triangle itself, that's made up of I, you and we, is a kind of building block. It actually underlies all of the physical geometries. We do use squares and pentagons and hexagons and octagons and decagons in the basic geometric shapes, but all of those are fundamentally made up of two different sorts of triangle. And he suggests that we can really concentrate on the triangle as a means of giving ourselves something to concentrate on. The thing is, this is a mobile meditation. If you can imagine in your own mind an equilateral triangle, a triangle where all the angles are the same and all the sides are the same length. Daniel also suggests that it can help to put it over your second chakra centre, which is somewhere below your tummy button, but just a bit above your pelvis.
It's the sacral, isn't it?
Yeah, the sacral chakra. Then that can help as well. Because that is the power centre of the energetic body. And the triangle helps us to connect with that, which is the power centre that's driving the whole system. In the phenomenal thought vibrations of the universal dream, we need all the power we have to simply survive, let alone be active. The triangle is a visual and actual energetic source of power in the dream. The breath, the one point, and the triangle. These are the roots and our gateway to the dream of the universe. When we are sure of our breath and sure of the point of our power, there is no chance of getting lost, and we are ready to travel. So that seems more or less to have used up our allotted time on MSI tonight. I'd like to thank you very much for joining me, Synchro.
That's all right.
I really appreciate that. And like I say, there's the thing is that in the long run, this goes a lot further. I'll give you some idea in a moment, but I'd just like to finish with another quote from Daniel's book, because I think it's a really great summary of these extremely... They're complex but simple ideas, these. Once you start getting involved with them, it's the mind, it's the thinking mind that puts us off. As soon as you start experimenting with it. Perhaps you'd just like to mention the sparkly things in the sky.
Oh, yeah. Let's mention the sparkly things. I don't know if anybody who's listening has ever looked into the sky, preferably on a sunny blue sky day, and... What you need to do is look at a point beyond the sky, if you like, and then see if you can see any dancy, sparkly little beings with a light at their... They're like sparks from a fire. You know, when you have a big bonfire and those sparks fly off into the sky, leaving little trails, they're just like that.
And they're very bright.
Very, very bright. I don't know if anybody in there has seen those, but I would highly recommend you take a look if you haven't seen them. And like I say, you sort of go out of focus on the sky itself, what's in between you and beyond the sky.
Because they always look to me like they're between me and the sky.
Well, they are in a sense, but you need to focus on somewhere beyond the sky to see them.
It is amazing, folks, how many people we mention this to who have never seen them before, but when they look up into a bright blue sky, suddenly they see the sky full of them.
Yeah.
And I find that if you practice the single point, if you try and keep your eyes on a point somewhere in the distant sky and keep them still, what you get to see is not only longer trails on the back of these things, and they really look like little beings. They kind of look like they're alive and flying around and
they're
dancing.
Definitely alive and dancing.
Once you do the single point thing and try and keep your eyes on a single point, you start to see really complex geometries formed by these things just in the moment as they kind of flow by.
Yeah.
So they're a good thing to practice on. They're much more interesting than staring at the wall.
Yeah.
Although you can find more interesting things inside when you close your eyes. I'll find all manner of stuff in there. Another really great thing to try the single point meditation on, all geometry is good for it, flower life, even six-pointed stars, squares, anything, doesn't really matter. But one really great thing is a collection of triangles that was put together, I think, over in the Buddhist world, and it's called the Sri Yantra. It's spelled like that, S-R-Y-Y-N-T-R-A. Mm. If you stick that Sri Yantra pictures into a search engine of your choice, then you will come up with loads of amazing images. And those are really great because there's a point in the middle that's really simple and points of varying complexity on the outside, which are the things that your subconscious, if you like, will be taking in. So that's it. A little bit of trying to help people to explore their dreams, if they can remember them. There'll be more stuff from Serena on that next week, and more stuff from us probably in the future as well. But also the skills necessary to help you do that can improve one's attention in the waking dream that we find ourselves occupying. And Daniel says that what we're doing, he says that from the opposition of thinker and thought came the dreamer and the dreamed. There is one mind, but there is not one dreamer. There are dreamers. The transformation from the one mind to the many dreamers is the creation of time. Dreamers slow down the energy of the mind. They slow down the thought vibrations. The dreamers go into the light source, thought, and slow the energy down by focusing on one part. By dividing all of time, timelessness, and all of space, infinity, they make some time and some space. This is workable. The dreamer can then use the energy of the thinker like the film projectionist uses light to project the film. The thinker is the light, time and space, the screen. The dreamer is the filmmaker, a filmmaker who doesn't completely understand the energy of the film. It can never be entirely controlled. So that's about it from me and Synchro for this week. We'll play some tunes. It's important to remember, like the man said, in the context of this kind of discussion, that we need to remember, or you need to remember, I need to remember, the light at the end of the tunnel may be you.